to another episode of Multifaithful. My name is Arianis, and I'm with the Office of Global Spiritual Life at NYU. This week's episode, we are joined by two Zen Buddhist monks, Koshin and Chodo, who run the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. We talk about death and finding joy in death, and a totally different approach to thinking about the end of life. Definitely a different and interesting and new conversation for the podcast. It was incredibly insightful and amazing, so I hope you all enjoy and listen. I'd love to hear your thoughts after. Thanks for listening to Multifaithful, and out of this week's conversation. I am joined today by Sensei Koshin, Sensei Chodo, from the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
So what I've heard about you two, and we just met about 10 minutes ago, and it's been really fun so far, but what I've heard about the two of you is that you're both hilarious, and you love dealing with death. And somehow those two are related and related to the New York Zen Center. So I was told to ask you two about your sense of humor and death and start the conversation there. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you're doing at the center. And how sort of all that ties together.
So the New York Zen Center of Contemplative Care is now 9 years old, and it's an educational nonprofit organization dedicated to intimacy with old age, sickness, and death. And we do that through our education programs, our direct care programs at the bedside, and Zen meditation training. And the heart of our work is how to be intimate with what's happening. And sometimes what's happening is funny, and sometimes what's happening is sorrowful or infuriating or joyful. And so it's, to me, it's about how to be with whatever is happening.
Yeah, I think, well, I know that death is a serious issue, and yet, as you point out, that there are some times when in situations when families are gathered or we're talking about certain things to a person that is dying, and they're actually recounting their own personal histories, and sometimes it can be really funny. And this idea that when someone is on their deathbed, it has to be all kind of angst and sadness is not always the case. And also, in order, I think, for us to maintain the work that we're doing, we do have to have a sense of humor about life and death and everything in between.
And I think also one of the beauties of working with dying people is that you are reminded every day that this is it. And so to be joyful and grateful that we're here, and to see the beauty and the humor and the sorrow all together, and to not hold back.
Yeah.
And so that we realize, and I realize all the time, that this is it, this is it. So we're, all the points where we're holding back is a deprivation of the one chance, as far as we know, to really live.
So on your, I was watching all the videos you have on your website to explain sort of what you do and how you do it, which are actually, I love them, they were great. One of the women who is profiled in the videos talks about how she was working in a hospital setting and would come out of working with people who are dying just crying every day. And after going through and learning some of the skills that you talk about and learning, I guess, your method for dealing with this, she almost like leaves with a sense of elation and joy now. For people who don't know a lot about Buddhism or don't understand so much like being present, like the concept of being present is sort of a little foreign to them, is there any way you could present like a very concrete or almost drill down to people like how do you do that? Because that seems, it almost seems magical to some extent that you can have someone shift their perspective that far. You're both raising your hand because you want to answer it. I think we can play rock, paper, scissor. It goes definitely. It sounds great on audio because everyone knows exactly what's happening.
Well, I think it, you know, it isn't just about Buddhism. It's about, it's really about being, having the capacity to be present to the moment. And part of our training, or a lot of our training in this area, is about being able to recognize what is yours and what is mine. I can sit in the room with someone who is in incredible pain or in incredible emotional, physical distress and be fully present to them and yet not get enmeshed in their story. I have to be able to fully realize what am I in this equation. I'm there to companion you, to join you in your journey, but not to get enmeshed with you. And, you know, so many caregivers and so many professionals have this idea that if you put this veil up in front of you, this invisible veil or wall between you and the patient or the person who's dying, that you will not be affected by this day after day after day mm-hmm. after day, which in actual fact is a myth. We need to have that veil down. Koshin, talk a little bit about that.
Well, we actually have to have the veil up, right? Lift the veil, learning to lift the veil. And
oh, right. We do. I was seeing the veil coming down, like, falling to the floor.
Ah, yeah.
Without lifting it up. Okay. Yeah.
Down or up?
Yeah.
No more veil. Either way.
No more veil. The veil's gone. Nix the veil. The wedding's over.
So I think for me, the work is about empathy and compassion. So most of us are empathic beings, unless we're, you know, it's rare to find an unempathic being. Mm-hmm. And empathy is neutral. It's just the quality that means that you feel what's happening in yourself and others. And some of us have more skills at that and more awareness of that, and some of us have less of that. And so what we're teaching is compassion practice about what do you do with that feeling and how do you move more into yourself and into relationship. But a simple kind of explanation of what our work is becoming the person, like most of us have had in our life, at least one person who, when we talk to them, is really looks at them and really is listening. And for some reason in our culture, there's so few relationships like that. Hmm. That people are so busy. People are so into even saying that they're busy or they're crazy busy. Or
especially in New York, people love to talk about how busy they are.
And it's fascinating to me that I've really consciously been not using that word mm-hmm. because I don't even know really what it means. Because to me it means that you're engaged in things that you don't really want to be engaged in. Mm-hmm. And we have very full lives, but for me it feels like an engaged life. It doesn't feel like I'm busy, I guess on some level. But I think that how do you learn how to be a compassionate person? And compassion is an action. Like what flows from actually really listening and being where you are, which is easy to say.
Right.
And it's, but all of our training, whether it's our Zen training or all of our education programs, it's really designed around this compassion practice, learning how to be free and liberated through that. Right.
Yeah. And it does make sense. And I guess it's an interesting thing to think, like, you can teach compassion. I feel like we often talk about compassion as not necessarily as a skill, as like a character trait that's innate. So the people who are coming to you to train to be better at this, they're from everywhere. Am I right?
We've had rabbis and nuns and acrobats and yogis and house husbands and house wives and
Iraqi war, Afghanistan veterans.
We've had really across pre-med students the whole range. And but what I think draws people is that there's something desperately missing mm-hmm. in terms of like how to be together.
And I don't think it's
in themselves and others.
I don't think it's about teaching compassion. I think it's about helping one to uncover their own innate capacity
absolutely.
For compassion. You know, no matter how over the years through their environment or their upbringing they've covered this capacity up as a defense mechanism, to really uncover that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like emotional archaeology, chipping away at all the, you know, all the defenses that we've built up over the years to uncover that, which we already innately have. You know, we call it Buddha nature, true nature.
Mm-hmm. And you were recently, the two of you were profiled by the New York Times, and I know that I can tell within NYU people are more interested, you know, students are getting progressively more interested in this area or this topic, whether they call it mindfulness or they're interested in Buddhism or they're interested in mindfulness-based stress reduction, just using these techniques. Why is this, like, what is, I feel like these ideas, or at least through a Buddhist prism, are fairly new to most people in the United States. Why are they all of a sudden taken off in this way, and what's sort of behind? I know it's a large question. What are some of the factors at play here? I see a hand.
One of the things that, as you're asking that question, that occurs to me, and it may be totally off base, is, but being a baby boomer myself, with four missing teeth right now, being a baby boomer myself, and knowing my contemporaries have practiced Buddhism for years and years now, their own children growing up in those households, we're already more exposed to the ideas of mindfulness, compassionate care. So I think it's in part to do with the baby boomers and their education of their children. And now we're seeing, you know, the millennials coming in that really are much more open to this. I think it almost skipped a generation. You know, the baby boomers, then you had the X generation. But the millennials are, I think, really open to it. Yes, Christian. Being a Generation X, why don't you give us your philosophy on this, your wisdom?
Well, I don't think any of us know for sure. Like, yeah. There's not probably one cause, but I think that one of the things that we know right now, for example, students coming into college now, one of their biggest concerns is, how am I going to have a conversation with someone? Mm-hmm. And how am I going to look at people? Their greatest anxieties about going to college now are actually about communication. Because there's this real breakdown in our society around community and relationships around that are not actually very connected. So people are trying to figure out, how do I live? How do I figure all of this out? Because no one is given that anymore. There used to be, you know, religions and small towns and communities were much stronger, but that is just not the way the world is right now. And the way the world is right now is that people are kind of left to their own devices, and they don't have what even the any kind of map about how to connect. And that's, to me, the greatest desire for people, is to really learn how to connect. And I think that's also why many relationships are failing, is that people are then putting everything onto one relationship and expecting that person to be their lover, their best friend, their provider, their everything. And because we used to live in a world where that those relationships were lived in many people. And now we're at a stage where people, I think, are inquiring, like, well, who am I? And how do I make these kind of decisions? People don't even know how to think about it, because people have not learned how to reflect, because we live in a country and a world where that used to come from the outside in and inform who you are was part of your social location and cultural location. And now it's, to me, it feels like much more up for grabs. But I don't know. Those are just,
we have some idea.
These are sitting there, my musings.
Musings.
I'm looking at this, I think it's a postcard.
Yeah.
Of matzo ball soup.
Yes.
And
student gave that to me as a thank you card at the end of working here.
Uh-huh. And I was thinking, as Kochan was talking, you know, if you take each of those components of that postcard, you've got the dish, you've got the stock, and you've got the carrots and the matzo ball on the top there. Take those as individual components, and really what do you have? You have a big piece of white dough, some orange vegetables, and some murky-looking water in a dish, but put them all together and you've got this incredible, wonderful matzo ball soup. It's kind of like relationships, you know, how do we all come, how do we bring it all together to taste the beauty of relationship? This, all this in relationship makes beautiful soup. Take it apart and it's just mush.
And that's very much why we started the center, because we saw, you know, even in Zen communities or different communities that we're in, that they were quite isolated in ways and people didn't know how to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And also, which is a skill, and mm-hmm. it's a practice in itself. Relationship is a practice.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw, you know, in hospitals and hospices that people didn't really know how to talk to each other either.
Yeah.
And so we thought, well, why don't we put it together? You know, put these things together. So learning about, you know, a meditative practice and caregiving and relationship. And relationship being the key and the ground.
So how much traction is this getting within healthcare? Because I know personally, like my father's an oncologist, and I've had similar conversations with him any time about the way he communicates and connects with patients. And I have also personally just like very vivid memories of when my grandfather in his last few years when he was in a nursing home, and it was a matter of time before he was going to pass away. And I was certainly not able to communicate with him as well as I would have wanted. I think most people in that situation feel that way. And I'm curious, so how much traction is this getting outside of maybe just one, like a community in Brooklyn that you've created, but sort of in a bigger picture? And how many people are like coming in with similar stories that I'm relaying and saying, like, this is what's bringing me to it?
Well, I would think everyone who comes through the door has a similar story.
I think there's no question that it's going to take a while, you know, before it becomes mainstream in the healthcare system. But, you know, in the 9 years that we've been creating this new paradigm, we're already on the faculty of the Integrated Medicine Department at the Koshin smiling. If you had a camera here, you'd understand.
There's definitely a layer to this podcast that if this were a video podcast, people would get a better appreciation for the looks and everything that's happening. But unfortunately, we're stuck with audio for at least a large part of
where it. We're on the faculty.
At the University of Arizona Medical School, and also at the McGovern School of Medicine at University of Texas, Houston. And our curriculum is now used in 35 medical residency programs across the country. But I think that, you know, it's a quiet movement and mm-hmm. revolution. And what we see is that it's mostly being led by patients, families, loved ones, and organizations like ours. And individual doctors and nurses and social workers, incredible people. But I think that true change only will happen when everyone rises up and saying that we actually demand to, and we deserve the respect and dignity of being looked at, of being listened to. It's like the things that, the most basic things that actually everyone wants, it seems like is the rarest commodity, is to actually have the attention and care that every being deserves. And it doesn't take a lot of time to do that. It takes a moment to really receive someone with your eyes.
And the exciting thing too, though, is, you know, the hospitals we're working with here in New York and in Brooklyn, you know, we're being introduced to the new students, the new med students and the fellows and the residents that are, again, the millennials and the Gen X physicians that are not yet weighed down by the old school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the way you do it. You don't talk about death and dying. You don't have relationships with your patients. You know, boom, 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 boom. They're seeing the need for a different way to interact with the patients, which is a beautiful thing to see. And they're very excited when we're presenting these ways of relating to each other. It's very uncomfortable at first for the students.
Yeah, I can see why.
We actually get them to look at each other and, you know, to tell each other a story, you know, role-playing, patient, physician.
And what percentage of the students in that moment are just thinking about, I need to go to the library to study for
99%. At the beginning of the presentation, and then as we work through it, you know, whether we're there for 4 hours or 4 days, there becomes this total shift in approach and attitude. Yeah, the person in front of me also is aging, will get sick, and will die, just as I will. And how can I be in relationship to that as well as to them? You know, how does it, we just become not separate to each other?
Finding the places of unity, which are actually through connection. Yeah, it's so beautiful.
Are you at all worried about, I mean, you're both clearly deeply steeped in Buddhism and living a Zen life. Are you worried about, and this is a concern I've heard other people echo, almost like a commodification of certain ideas within Buddhism, and sort of people losing broader context or losing a broader understanding, just like plucking an idea out? Is that something that concerns you, or you think that if it's a good idea and it's helpful anyway, that that's a good thing? Like, how do you navigate that? Because I know this is, especially because a lot of these ideas are not, they're not new to the world. They're just new to a lot of people who are either listening to this podcast or they're new to me. But how do you go about that? I can see I have two eager guests to answer that question.
Yes, Roshan.
I think that the taking of some ideas and putting it into something else is probably the oldest thing in the world. It is nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether it's mindfulness or, you know, different kinds of prayer or meditation have been taken out of their original context, if there even is an original context. Mm-hmm. But to me, all of it is just evolving. And our commitment to a particular practice and tradition and lineage is our particular commitment to that lineage, and I don't think that it's not for everybody. And some people want just a taste, and some people want more. And I think, to me, you know, the main point is for people to reflect on, is the person offering it, or do they feel ethical about what they're doing? And that's always a interest of mine, but it's not what everyone thinks about, for sure.
An eager hand.
Yes, Chodo.
I think where it gets murky is, and I agree with you, Koshin, that, you know, it's you know, for centuries people have been taking bits from here, bits from there. We don't know where anything really originates. But where it gets murky is when you have someone that maybe comes into a center for, you know, a 6-week training or a 3-month training, and then they get some kind of certificate or some kind of approval from a teacher who may not have been around that long themselves to say that they can go off and do this. That's where it gets a little, as I said, a little murky, because unless you're really steeped in your own practice, you're going to come up against difficulties when you have a student who is going through a particularly rough emotional time, or, you know, even sometimes breakdowns.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you're really steeped in this practice, it's going to be, could be quite problematic.
And I think it's always like the, in some ways, like a bell curve in a way anyway, is that some people will be, you know, very gifted and sharing things, but most people are okay. And then some people are not so good and are not so helpful. And of course, that's totally subjective too.
Mm-hmm.
And so the teaching that might resonate for me is not going to be what resonates for somebody else. I've gone to places that I didn't resonate with, and yet for many people, it's like their home.
Mm-hmm.
And how beautiful. And to me, that's the beauty of life too, is that there are so many flavors And I think it gets tricky thinking that there's a right one or a pure one.
That's the beauty of New York City, sketchy. Too, isn't it? I mean, there are so many opportunities to meditate, to practice. It's not about Zen. It's not about one particular thing. When people come to our center for the first time, we always make a point afterwards at the end of the evening to speak with them and say, listen, you know, this may have not been the place for you. Mm-hmm. Give it another shot. Give it two or three times. And there are plenty of other places in Manhattan where you could try, see what fits for you. But the important thing is that I think for all of us is to find a place where we can really sit.
And show up.
And show up for ourselves and for our communities and for the world. You know, and unless you're really sitting with yourself, that's never going to happen.
So if you're going to then leave sort of a listener who maybe is listening to this and there's a loved one in their life that is going through something difficult, or they have someone in their life who's approaching the end of life, if you could give a 2 to 3 minute, just a very quick, something that as they're listening they could kind of take with them as a quick way to distill down, besides that they should come for further things or explore it more seriously, but how would you present that, or what would you say to someone?
Well, two things, that death is very ordinary. You know, we've been doing it for centuries. You know, we're born, we die. And also, death is not an emergency usually. You know, if we're with someone that's transitioning in a natural way, we can often get caught up in what's going to happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how, where are we going to, you know, who's going to be here in the last moments, where are they going to be buried, what does the memorial service look like, all that stuff. Rather than being just in the moment, each hour, each day, as the person is transitioning towards whatever we think about death as being. So there's no, unless it's a traumatic event when someone is aging appropriately and dying, there's no emergency there. There's no urgency. You know, the thing that we need to think about most is, what is the best way to take care of this person? The most loving way, the most wholesome way. And many families, particularly in cities like ours, you know, where families are dispersed, this is where our center comes in with our students, that we have to provide some kind of spiritual environment.
Presence.
What would you say if you're summing it up in 2 to 3 minutes? That I just took. I just took your 2 to 3 minutes.
No, you took yours.
I took mine. I took Ariel's 2 to 3 minutes.
It's all right. This is the advantage of a podcast, is it pretty much ends when our conversation ends. So there are many more versions of 2 to 3 minutes if you want to give it a few goes.
So first of all, for me, if you're facing challenge, the greatest challenge is to welcome whatever is happening, even if you feel unwelcome about it. It's not what you want. How do you learn how to welcome whatever is arising and not push away anything, and to really investigate what you're afraid of? And to me, in order to do that, we have to have quiet. So having some form of quiet so that you can have your own awakened mind and receptivity. You know, many people, you know, I know this as, you know, I was a primary caregiver myself. The receptivity to your own experience of when you're getting just so fried and that you need to go and just take care, so that you can offer care. And so receptivity. And the last one to me is our friend Tarona. I love this so much. She's a primary care physician.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked people, who are the 5 people who you could call right now and they would come over right now and talk to you, to nurture those relationships? And she talks about, too, that many people now come into her office and can't think of one person who would drop everything and come. They think, like, well, maybe there's this one person. So to me, about how do you nurture those relationships? And how do you learn how to ask for help and let the community, let yourself have some kind of community, whether it's a neighbor or a spiritual community or a family member, the person in the grocery store, whoever it is. And we've heard amazing stories of, like, actually a grocer who used to look after this old woman who used to come into the grocery store, and then she used to order the food to be brought to her house, and then when she was so weak, he used to just bring her food.
That's sweet.
You know, because there was no one else.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we each think about how we can participate in life and how we care for ourselves and others and not see them as two things?
And how do we do it way before the time of crisis, you know? We should be thinking about this every day, for, you know, no matter how old we are. This is the kind of high school students should be learning this stuff. You know, how do we take care?
Definitely didn't teach me this stuff in high school.
No, is probably the most valuable thing you could offer someone,
right?
You know, like, how to have meaningful, supportive, nurturing relationships
to instill in everyone. Guess what? You will die at some point. You know?
And you will need people.
And you will need people around you. And it's sadly lacking in our education.
So far.
So far. Hopefully it will change. Right?
That's what our work's about.
I think that's what Ariel is all about. I think he needs to change the work.
I need to change it all.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you have to get NYU down.
Well,
down with the death.
Down with the death.
Down with dying.
That sounds like a campaign that if I started here at NYU would definitely become popular.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Get down with dying.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. With Ariel, get down with dying. get down.
That's hysterical. If I know you also just wrote a book, so if maybe you could just talk, besides going to the New York Zen Center, Furka Temple of Care, the website, seeing the resources, maybe coming to the center, if you want to tell people a little bit about the book and just other resources that are available before we have to finish up.
Sure. So the book is called Awake at the Bedside, Contemplative Teachings on Palliative and End-of-Life Care. And the book, what we found was to be the most useful book is to have community. So that's an anthology. And so we gathered together the Buddhist teachers and physicians who are really working and leading change in this area of a different way of being in relationship to suffering and end-of-life care. And so they wrote original pieces for the book. And it's designed to be a companion and be available to just pick up and get nourished, because it's full of nourishment and soul, but it's also not filled with answers, but it's designed to be a companion so that you realize you're not alone and that actually no one knows how it's going to go, but how you're in it is really the heart of the book. And we've gotten amazing feedback, and apparently it's like a best-selling book on Amazon.
Well, that was preempting my next question. I was going to say, where can people get it? Yeah. In all the usual places that people now get books.
Awake at the Bedside, Amazon.com. Barnes & Noble has it. But Amazon.com is the place to go, because it's like, boom, one click. Ship.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So it's doing very well. And apparently, you know, and the beauty is getting, you know, these beautiful emails from nurses and like Baton Rouge, saying, like, a Baptist nurse in Baton Rouge who's saying, like, this book just so speaks to her and about how nourishing it is. And people who have dying friends and dying themselves have all been writing these beautiful letters about how it touches them and they feel less alone. So it's really a book to give to yourself or to someone that you know who is going through a transition, or a clinician that you love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like your father, who's an oncologist, maybe.
Yeah, I think he would like it.
I think every oncologist should read it.
I think he's a little delayed on where he is in listening to these podcast episodes, so he may get to this in like a month from now.
So you should give him the book. Give him the book and then tell him to listen to the podcast.
I know. Well, thank you, both of you, for coming in. This has been a great conversation. Definitely one of the... Definitely a conversation touching on topics that we don't usually cover, or that I don't usually talk much about. So this has been great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. We'd especially like to thank our guests, Kosher and Chodo, for being amazing guests and for... definitely being the funniest and most adorable guests we've had on the podcast thus far. Especially thank you to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast, and to all of you for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and we look forward to having you back for an episode again in 2 weeks.